I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Rachel Pemberton. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Michael.
Rachel, you have been around Fremantle and the council, probably not as long as Doug Thompson I interviewed recently from the North Ward, but for a fair while. I think you may have come here as a little girl.
Yes, I was really fortunate and have thanked my dad many times for making the family move to Fremantle. We did that in July 1984. I was about 6.5 years old. And
was it a beautiful day like today in the middle of July when you came? Can you remember?
I don't remember much about the weather. I remember it was cold. I don't think it was raining. We weren't hiding out or anything like that. But my distinct memory of the first day is such a lovely one, where the removalists had literally just finished up and driven away. And I was sitting on the couch in the lounge room with my mother and my little sister, Anna. And one of the neighbours walked down the hallway, Christine Gosfield, with her daughter Leila and son Toby in hand, and said, "Hello, who are you? We're your new neighbours." And introduced, we were like family ever since.
Well, that sounds like that neighbour who I think I also know. Well, that's a nice welcome, and Fremantle is that sort of place, isn't it? And so you were schooled around here?
Yes, I went to South Terrace Primary School, which is now Fremantle Primary School, for the first few years, and then moved across to Richmond, and then in high school I was at John Curtin.
Well, you've absolutely, totally Fremantle, not born but bred.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I've often reflected on the fact that I've lived within a 1 kilometre radius of the house I grew up in on Solomon Street for most of my life. I've ventured out a couple of times, lived a year in Melbourne and a year in Northbridge and a year in Bicton and a couple of years in Hamilton Hill, but other than that, it's been a 1 kilometre radius of that house on Solomon Street.
Well, it's good to have some experience of the world outside Fremantle. Now, you've been a member of the council for the City Ward since about 2011.
Yes, that's right.
That's quite a while now.
Yeah,
How did you get onto council? Why did you get into local government?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one, really. I never really planned to or expected to. I guess I've always been very interested in civic life. My parents raised me to get involved in and have my say in kind of public debate and so on. I wrote letters to the council asking them for bins on Fothergill Street as a kid and asking them to reinstate the chessboard in King Square and
quite right.
Various other things just as a child. In fact, the heritage officer pulled up my submission on King Square, a letter that I wrote to the Lord Mayor when I was 7. And but it wasn't something I'd really thought about at all. I actually got asked to run the first time a long time ago by Les Lauder, actually. And I think it was because he was familiar with my parents, who were very involved in the Fremantle Society. But I didn't really understand what was involved and didn't really understand why he was asking me and said no. And then in 2009, I helped Brad in his election campaign for mayor. And I got to see a bit of what went on in council, and the new team that got elected at that time were a really interesting progressive team, and there was a real exciting feeling about the potential and the effort being made towards breathing new life into Fremantle. And I eventually started to think I might like to be a part of that. I still didn't actually put my hand up initially. It was Kathy Hall who convinced me. So in 2011, Kathy was encouraging me profusely, and I said, no, why do I need to be on council? I volunteer and I contribute in other ways. I've got a direct line of communication with the councillors and a good relationship, and I get things done that way. And she said, yes, but you'll get more done if you're at the table. And women in particular, they always tend to feel They don't need the status of the position. They don't need the formality. They're happy to do the work behind the scenes and be influential in informal ways. And we need more women like you at the table making the decisions, not asking the favours.
That convinced you.
It did. Yeah, she was persuasive.
We should tell the listeners to this interview that we're doing an outside broadcast today, as we do occasionally in these interviews. We're in the park in Coral Street, South Fremantle, which is rather pretty, due for an upgrade soon. And one of the locals here has been taking his rubbish bins in, which just goes to show the council services are right on time. Now, that's 2009. You're not on the council from what you've just said. Your approach to run Brad Pettit's campaign, that's for mayor at that point, is it?
Yes.
Now, what skills did you bring? What had you done that made you appropriate to run a campaign for a local government mayoral election?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a bit of a roundabout way of coming into politics, I guess. I studied arts management at WAPA, the Academy of Performing Arts, and I had a real interest in the music industry in particular and arts, and I had a real natural affinity with the realm of marketing. I can still remember my first marketing lecture and sitting there and just going, oh wow, this is the stuff that happens in my head naturally and it's called marketing. I didn't know that. And so I'd done that degree and was working for Luna Palace Cinemas for a very long time, and eventually over in Melbourne and their head office as National Marketing Manager for Palace Films, actually. And the 2004 federal election was called and I ran away to join the political circus. I resigned my job and was employed to run the election campaign for the federal seat of Melbourne. And so I guess I kind of cut my...
So who was that for?
That was for the Greens. It wasn't Adam Bandt at that stage. It was a candidate called Gemma Pinnell. And the Greens in Melbourne, in Victoria, knew that that seat was potentially winnable for them in the future.
Which Adam Bandt eventually proved.
Yes, that's right. Two elections later, Adam Bandt won it. Mm. So they knew that by investing resources and capabilities in the seat, you know, for a couple of elections in lead up, they would build their vote enough to be able to win.
I'm assuming you're engaged as a Greens member at that point. You're interested in politics and you become involved in that campaign.
Yeah, well, I wasn't a member. I had to join in order to do the job. And I was very much aligned to the Greens. I supported the Greens because basically it was a little bit like the marketing thing. It just resonated. It was the same values that I shared. They generally kind of coming from the same space and they care about the things I care about. It was something I'd never done before. It was really quite different, but it was still utilising all my skills around production of materials, organising events, doing outreach, like media liaison and that sort of stuff, as well as kind of organising volunteers and that sort of stuff. So I learned how a campaign works by doing that, basically. Mm. And then I came back to WA in 2005 and was asked to run a campaign for Lynn McLaren in the seat for South Metro here, which I then did. And I've sort of ended up doing elections since then, regularly, and it really is just around utilising my marketing background and communications kind of professional experience for, you know, politics and issues-based things.
I sense you've enjoyed it.
Mostly, yes.
And it has a very intense period, I imagine, every campaign. You think about leading up to when the vote's going to be, and then it's no doubt very intense, but it's always with you, I imagine.
It is. The thing I like about elections, or I did like about elections, is that there's an end date. There's a very clear finish line. And so I've always sort of felt like I put in, you know, as much as I possibly can, 150% of my capacity. And you can do that. You can pull off sort of superhuman feat and effort because you know that there's a finish point and so on. But to be honest, that all sort of came to a crashing halt and I broke myself in the 2013 federal election. 2013 was a challenging year because we had a mayoral election, a state government election, and a federal election. And at the time, I was working.
You were involved in all of them.
I was involved in all of them, and I was working for Scott Ludlam, the senator at the time, and of course that was the year that he didn't quite win, and they had to do the Senate recount, the vote recount, so that kind of dragged it on initially. And then of course they found out that they'd lost votes, and then we had to run the election again, and I didn't cope with that very well.
that's a separate chapter for the memoir, I expect.
It is, yes.
Now in 2011, just before all of that, you get onto local government council here in the city of Fremantle. And at that point, were you effectively running as a Green? Were you espousing a certain set of a platform to be elected?
Look, it's an interesting one. I mean, obviously here in WA, we don't have formal party politics
in local government.
Yeah, I've always been, I've disclosed completely that I'm, you know, anybody can Google my name and you will see it attached to a whole bunch of media statements from the Greens and things like that. So I've never tried to hide it. And when asked, you know, certainly do say so. But at the same time, the Greens don't have policies in an area that relates to local government in particular. I mean, there's obviously, you know, it's values driven, and that applies to local government very much so. And I think, you know, I'm quite open and honest, and you can see from my voting record and debate and so on that it certainly aligns with those kind of policies and values and so on. But there isn't any formal way of party interfering with how I might go about making my decisions or anything like that. They don't know about the planning sort of stuff, etc. But what was really useful, being a councillor as well as working for a federal senator during those years, was that, you know, the work we were doing on the federal sort of sphere was the big picture, holistic, systemic change. And at the local council level, it was the on the ground actual implementation of those kind of concepts.
Yes.
And doing those two things simultaneously was a fantastic opportunity and really great, you know, insight into both, so that both of those realms could be done better.
Once upon a time, I don't know if people still say it, but it was think global and act local.
Yes.
You were living it out.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was great.
Now you've got a website with your name on it.
Yes.
And I think it sets out some of the things that you have achieved and are proud to mention, and they seem to align with those sorts of values you were mentioning. What things did you get involved in then in those earlier days on the council that took effort and where minds had to be changed and you feel very pleased about?
Yeah, well, I guess my first sort of foray into being engaged with council in those times was the Cappuccino Strip Street Club. So
what was that about?
That came about because
a lot of people think they're a member of the Cappuccino Strip Club.
Yeah, well, it was a lovely community initiative. So the Fremantle Network is a sort of informal discussion group that Brad and I kind of formed many years ago, just before around about the time he first became mayor or just before then. And one of the discussions we had in that forum was with David Enwicht, who was a well-known placemaker who was over here in Western Australia doing some workshops and things. And he was sort of talking about the ability of the community to kind of reclaim their public spaces and activating public spaces through, you know, really kind of diverse means and low cost means and so on. And at the time there was a conversation going on about an upgrade to the Cappuccino Strip and whether or not there's traffic on it and various other things. And we kind of went, well, let's do some trials and see how the community will use this space by inviting them down. And, you know, and also at that stage, Fremantle was quite busy on weekends and it felt like the Cappuccino Strip wasn't really there for the community, it was there for the tourists and visitors for so much of the week. So on Thursdays we took over the street and just had a big party with the community. And that kind of transferred over into my kind of engagement with council, I guess, around things like placemaking and trying to make make the city more vibrant and livable and welcoming to locals as well. And so we created the Market Street Piazza from that.
Which is a lovely space.
It is. And it's a real shame because of the tenancies being vacant around, yes, you know, when that kind of finally came to fruition.
Corona hit us.
Yeah, and then Corona, so it's just been terrible. But it's a beautiful space that is ready for, like, and that's such a lovely spot in terms of being close to all the action, but just slightly removed enough so that families can feel comfortable with kids kind of running around and playing in the street and that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. And so that was quite good. And then some of the other early things that I did was the street arts policy. That was my first kind of major intervention. And I guess I kind of learnt how the system works a bit in doing that. And so that was around, you know, consulting with the community kind of widely and talking about whether or not we want to retain some of the creativity that occasionally happens that is unauthorized but worth retaining, and how you create kind of a distinction in terms of what you do get rid of because it's, you know, messy rubbish, and what you allow to stay because it's actually artistically creative and adds to the public realm
or otherwise captures the public's attention.
Yeah absolutely.
Now tell me, after 9 years serving on council, what did you learn, what have you learned about the way it functions? Was it what you've learned different from what you expected in those early days?
It is nothing like I expected, or I don't know what I expected, but it's certainly a massive learning curve when you first get on council. I'd say it takes at least 6 months just to kind of really get your head around how things are working. One of the other things that really struck me was I, like all council candidates, said, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And why don't we just do it like this? And then you suddenly realise it doesn't work like that. Like, for starters, there's all these regulations and things with it overlay what a council can and can't do, and where our power starts and finishes and so on. And then there's also, you know, the consultation with the community means that you've got a wide range of views and different, and things will impact different kinds of groups of people differently, and that as a councillor you need to factor in all of that, not just your friends or the people who think the same as you and so on. And so I guess becoming a lot more measured in terms of how I approach problems or opportunities or issues, just in terms of kind of going, okay, well, so how does this all work? Where is our capability in creating change? And then if we propose it, then how does we make that work for as many people in the community as possible?
And are there some particular examples of that?
Oh, so many. I mean, I guess the biggest change that I've been part of making is the Frio Alternative Planning Scheme, and that is definitely a good, complicated example. So that took about 5 or 6 years to get, so more than a full term.
Yes.
Basically, it came about because I was a, you know, single working professional woman wanting to have a house in Fremantle, buy a house in Fremantle, and just can't possibly afford it on one income, but had girlfriends in the same situation and kind of went, well, maybe we can all collaborate together and build a little eco village on a single block where we can have kind of small independent dwellings but some shared spaces and so on. And I went to Phil St John, who's now the CEO but at the time was the planning director, and asked him. There was a block in White Gum Valley in particular that we were looking at. And he said, no, you can't do it. You can build one really big house and a granny flat and that's it.
That's all the scheme allowed.
Yeah. And then I said, let's change that. And so we started to work through a process that did. And I guess part of the challenge was that what we were effectively doing was kind of throwing out the R codes, which is the sort of state operated standardisation for how housing and planning is done in WA, and then working with the community. I mean, we did multiple stages of community engagement on that, far more than was actually required under the legislation, in order to be able to get really clear with the community about what it is that they value and what kind of things they want to see in these sorts of housing innovation and opportunities. Maru, come.
We're also accompanied by a dog, people, as you might have gathered. Now, planning, you're, I think, on the planning committee.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the main committee for you?
It is now, yes. We kind of rotate around. So in the previous 2 years, I was on FPOL, the strategic planning and transport one, and audit and risk. And Aidan was on planning, and we swapped this last couple of years.
And yep. That's the way it works. The ward councillors, the two of you, swap around and keep things covered for the people
yes,
in your ward.
That's right. And audit and risk, we don't need a councillor from each ward on, but the other other committees have to have one of the two councillors on it. And the planning committee is usually the most complicated and heaviest workload one. So usually, yeah, so you're forgiven if you only do that one instead of two.
So when it comes to planning, there's also the what do they call them, the JDAPs or whatever.
Yes, yeah.
And how do you find the planning system working? Local governments weren't always that excited about losing local control, or what appeared to be a loss of local control.
Yeah, I serve on JDAP, so I'm a JDAP member on behalf of the City of Fremantle. And I've done that for quite some time. I don't really think it's a good system. I've never been a big supporter of the JDAP system. I think it was introduced, well, according to the conversation I had with Eric Lumsden at the time, it was introduced mainly with the view that there were many councils around the state, particularly the smaller ones, that just didn't have the skills and expertise within staff to deal with large, complicated development applications, and that in order to kind of streamline things for the development industry, they would take that off local government and give it to this other body known as JDAP.
It Which is what? Joint
Development Assessment Panel.
JDAP.
Yeah, and it's run by the WAPC, which is the West Australian Planning Commission. And each JDAP is made up of five people in total. So there's two local government representatives that will usually be councillors. And then there are three what they call expert panel members. And they are usually architects or planners or somebody who's within the profession. And I think it's very deliberately structured that way, because the expert members can always
outvote the local government concerned. Yeah.
And it doesn't always go that way, but it often does. And the argument is always, you know, that they are there to factor in the planning laws and regulations above everything else. And whereas I guess councillors are much more of a mind to also factor in things like the community feedback and opinion and things like that. So it's quite unfortunate.
Don't you enjoy the planning work?
I find it a really interesting area, yes. Now, I think it's, I want to change it dramatically. I don't think it's working as well as it should, but I do find it fascinating.
So what would you do to change it?
Oh, well, I'd throw out the R codes to start with. Yes, and they're terrible.
So, I mean, the R codes were brought in, as I recall it, and considered quite progressive at the time, to take out a lot of the, the difficulties that arose in judging a development proposal, particularly residential dwellings adjacent to each other and overlooking problems and community disputation. You had a fixed set of rules which, if you met, there it was. But it's a very standardised approach.
It is, and I think it works better in areas that are newly developed. So when you're kind of going out to a green field, or even just a major new estate or whatever, it just makes sense. You can just do the cookie cutter kind of version and follow by those rules, and it all kind of fits together well. In a area like Fremantle, and particularly City Ward, where you've got like historic streets and narrow blocks and all sorts of other things, it becomes a lot more complicated. But also it just throws up these really bland, boring houses that don't really serve anybody that well, really, from a functional aesthetic kind of thing, you know, like those highlight windows that end up everywhere because of they have to be 1.6 meters high, so that in theory you can't look through them. Just end up with these little strips. And that's not good for the person inside. It's not particularly good for the people, you know, looking at it from afar and that sort of stuff. And I guess I've always been a bit outspoken in my hatred of McMansions, and McMansions is the result of Yeah, the R codes. And also that's the problem whereby, you know, you can look at I often kind of see these things go up in various places and I go, how did that get approved? And then I realise it complies with everything. So, you know, it doesn't matter that it doesn't fit into the streetscape. It's ugly. It's not particularly functional. It's just, you know, playing by the rules and therefore allowed.
Yes. But Rachel, I get the impression when it comes to Fremantle, particularly City Ward, that getting people into Fremantle is the big thing.
Absolutely.
And particularly at the moment as we head sort of out of COVID, although one has the sense now we may never actually have it behind us. Getting people into the city is good for traders, it's good for people who are providing services to the community because there's a critical mass of people to serve. So getting appropriate development, running down the east side at the moment and the like, it seems to be a commonly held and accepted view for running Fremantle into the future. Is that about it?
It is. And I mean, it's a challenging one in some ways because I, as we started, you know, I've lived here all my life. I'm so attached to this place and too much change frightens me. You know, I see some of the changes going on, particularly in the CBD, and I go, oh my goodness, what have we done? Like, I hope it works. But at the same time, I also see that, yeah, businesses is suffering. There's not enough people out and about to keep the place feeling safe and vibrant and filled with life and so on. And I think, you know, the population of Fremantle has remained relatively stagnant for the past few decades, really. It's, you know, hovering around 30,000 people, and it has for at least 10 years and a lot more before that. I think we need to do it in a way that's kind of, you know, sensitive and appropriate and, you know, tailored for the different areas and so on. But also one of my things is that we really need more people here, like working here. We need a daytime economy during the week. And obviously the Department of Communities moving into the FOMO development in King Square is a big start on that. But realistically, I mean, you know, with the containerization of the port many years ago, reducing the number of port workers, and then the downgrading of the Fremantle Hospital, taking about 2,000 jobs away, but also a whole bunch of associated industries and services and so on. You know, I remember the head of the health department saying, you know, there has never been a downsizing and relocation of that scale anywhere in Australia. And I guess it's kind of like the equivalent of Maggie Thatcher closing the coal mines. And it's like, well, so what do you do? What's your transition plan? And obviously there's the discussion at the moment with Westport and the possibility of relocating the port either in its entirety or at least or partly to the south. And again, we really need to be thinking as a community, as well as pressuring government, what jobs replace that? What industries are going to come here instead? Like, how are we actually going to provide employment opportunities? And I guess we are really, really lucky because it's such a beautiful place that offers such a fantastic lifestyle. You can imagine there's a real desirability, you know, in terms of employers who want to attract high quality staff by having them be able to work in a wonderful place like Freo. You know, we've got a lot going for us, but we actually need to be on the front foot with that.
So are there any particular ideas that you would like to promote?
Yeah, well, so there's the film hub concept, which particularly Hannah Fitzharding and Jenny Archibald have been working on, which I think is exactly the kind of thinking we need, and is a really good natural affinity. I mean, it'd be fantastic if there was like a Netflix or a Google or something like that that decided to come and, you know, set up its headquarters here. That would be incredible. You know, maybe it's the next kind of industry that we don't know about and haven't thought of yet and so on. But, you know, I think there's real opportunity with the kind of, you know, sustainability, green tech kind of realm around how we transition to a lower carbon future. I think there's real potential in those sort of technical industries and so on, because, again, that's, you know, high value jobs that...
Well, particularly in a post COVID economy as well, because I get the sense that people's working practices are going to be different in the future, that people might work from their home office. for, say, a couple of weeks and then back to the main office, wherever it is, for a couple of weeks. And then you start to think, well, hang on, where are convenient places for people to work?
Yes.
People suddenly discover they're not commuting for an hour each way, each day, for 5 days a week, and say, well, if I live near Fremantle, wouldn't you want to work here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I could, and since about 2013, I've worked very flexibly in a variety of kind of jobs and roles, where famously I spent $1 million on advertising at South Beach in one campaign. And because you can work anywhere these days. I work in parks quite frequently so that the dog can hang about, cafes and that sort of thing. And we actually do have data that shows that a higher than average proportion of people in Fremantle do work from home. And so partly it's about harnessing and embracing that, or enticing them into the CBD, or, you know, to kind of hubs, so that there is that, you know, collaboration and synergy that can occur, but also that there is that foot traffic on the street, and hopefully businesses, you know, get some additional trade out of it.
Now, you've mentioned the port. There's the King's Square development, which is close to finish, and you've effectively mentioned that because that's where the community's couple of thousand people nearly are going to hopefully be.
They're all in
work.
Now. So, oh, yep, they are now. All officially in as of last week.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yep. So we'll all watch with great interest there. Mm. What other things are happening, or would you like, again, if you had your way, you were the emperor, the empress for a day or a month or for a full term, what sorts of things
would you
dream of?
If I could wave my magic wand.
Yes.
Oh, there'd be lots of things. I mean, in terms of that job creation and industries and so on, there has been a project that has been worked on in the background for the last couple of years around the redevelopment of the Fremantle Oval and the intensification or consolidation of the Fremantle Hospital site.
That desperately needs it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Even when the hospital was fully occupied, it's a, you know, sort of a ragtag collection of buildings. There's historic buildings in there. There's
absolutely, and lots of underutilized space, and, you know, there's all these kind of added on bits that, you know, were added at different times, and
yes,
and roadways and car parks in between, and various kind of, like, you walk along Atfield Street up towards the prison there, and you're just in this kind of wasteland area that is prime real estate, like, and up on that hill you've got the view and so on. And I imagine that there is a really great opportunity in that location to intensify the medical use in some ways. So maybe a private hospital, maybe some specialist facilities, maybe aged care or something like that, as well as the potential for residential development closer in to the Oval and to town. And that's been a project. So there was a working group I was part of that had been working on some preliminary kind of concepts and designs. And unfortunately, the state government and Department of Health have kind of held up any kind of public announcements. They kept saying that they would have an announcement to make soon. I think last Christmas they were supposed to do it, and the Christmas before, so that we could start debating, like discussing in detail with our community about this plan. But it has been continuing to progress in the background, and I think we as councillors have been talking about, you know, bringing that out into the open, regardless of what the state government wants to do. They can take their time and so on, but we want to talk to our community about this, and I think there's a real opportunity there. I mean, people have kind of compared it to the Claremont Oval redevelopment, and we're not talking about the same as that. I mean, obviously we've got the Fremantle Prison adjacent to it, and that's World Heritage listed and has a really important kind of buffer zone around it and so on that needs to be protected, and the opportunity to kind of connect up the Knoll, which is within the hospital complex.
But it's the broad concept that you can better utilise and repurpose.
Yes,
what's there.
And some of the lower utilised spaces and car parks and things that are away from the prison and sort of behind the hospital, the, you know, large tower block of the hospital, you know, you could do some intensification in those areas.
Within sort of historic Fremantle itself, which includes those areas you mentioned, but just take the high street, the commercial areas that with day-to-day traders are. Are there things that people want to see done? You have, people putting proposals to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think in general, the general thing is always sort of clean it up sort of thing. It's funny. It's like a lot of visitors don't necessarily notice the things that we as locals kind of, you know, gets on our goat. But I think a general, and this is something we've talked about with the economic development working group that has come about for the post-COVID kind of era, which is around what can we do to just spruce up and beautify and make sure there's, you know, better lighting in places like Pioneer Park, for example, and better kind of pedestrian thoroughfare and access, for example, between the Maritime Museum and the Shipwreck Gallery. I work for the museum, and often, you know, you're trying to describe to people how they find their way to the Shipwrecks Gallery, and it's really quite hard. That, you know, you can follow your nose and find it if you just trust your senses, but for locals who don't have that sense of direction or know where they're headed to, it's really hard. And I think that's probably a really critical project that should get done soon. So yeah, there's lots of those little things that are about fixing it up. I would really, really like to see, for me, a primary priority would be fixing up the station forecourt. So getting rid of, moving the buses away from the direct frontage to the train station so that you don't have all those fences and barricades between you and Queen Street, so that you could actually create a much better access way from the train station to King Square directly.
It's only going to need that. Fremantle, unfortunately, has got all of these sort of rough entrance areas, none of which are particularly beautiful. And if you're not a Fremantle local, you can actually get lost coming into Fremantle.
Absolutely.
You're not sure where to turn, where you can park. If you get off the train, you're not quite sure exactly where to go.
Yes.
And I have to say, I don't know when it was named Pioneer Park, but if I'm making a small complaint about things, I don't like the name Pioneer Park.
Okay.
So I don't know how long it's been there. I must investigate.
It's a good question, yeah.
But it might be that it looks like an sort of an underutilised or unthought out location in Fremantle with which more could be done.
Yes.
It's got the spare parts theatre sitting there, but even that's not immediately recognisable as something. Rather, it's a collection of brick.
Absolutely. And I think it was Kerry Hill Architects did a project for spare parts puppet theatre for a major upgrade of that facility, and it was a fantastic plan that actually kind of opened out onto the park and, you know, really kind of integrated and up like that forecourt and so on.
That and, you can imagine as a more major, yes, facility for performing arts in Fremantle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Yep.
Now, do you become involved in what's happening in the rest of Fremantle, or is having stepped out a couple of times in the course of your life and then come back to Fremantle, you don't go beyond the city ward?
absolutely. I love all of Freo, and as a councillor, once we're elected, of course, we are obliged by the Act to work in the best interests of the whole city, not just our ward. And of course, you know, through the various committees and all the various decisions, we always are dealing with issues in each other's wards and other parts of town. So, absolutely. And there's so much good here. There's so much to like, you know, and I'm always really keen to just embrace and harness that even more so, amplifying the good. And
now, perhaps we can finish on, not a negative topic, but the one that's challenging the entire planet, and that is the COVID period. I mentioned earlier I've started to develop the thought as I scan the media each day that this is never going to quite disappear. Parts of the world that came to controlling it late and reopened earlier suffering. The United States probably the most obvious case in point. Western Australia, we're doing quite well. Fremantle, we seem to be doing quite well, but how does Fremantle plan its way out of this? I mean, probably the regular burghers, everyone round about the whole of the city of Fremantle, communities have aligned nicely, people are talking to each other, there's a certain contentment, but economies are going to have to be active and well again.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it is a really challenging time, and I guess particularly for the economic impact in Fremantle specifically, we were, the timing couldn't have been worse. I mean, it literally, the shutdown began the week the first bunch of workers moved into the Department of Communities.
And yes.
So, you know, it's kind of held up that transformation that was supposed to happen this year. I really thought that this year was going to be a turning point for Fremantle and you know, it would be the line in the sand, the marker for, you know, the new reawakening and so on. Now, that's been kind of delayed and stalled a bit, but... And I guess the other side of it is, of course, the economic hit to the council itself, whereby we gave, you know, we own a bunch of properties for commercial purposes as investments that are leased, and we gave our tenants a lease break because, you know, they weren't able to operate and having a hard time as well. And we also made parking free so that people were encouraged, you know, if they did need to come into Fremantle, that it was easy and attractive and so on. And because we had managed over the years to diversify our income to the point where about 30% of our income came from non-rates, most of which was parking and leases, we've taken a massive financial hit in the budget, and we're not quite sure when that's going to normalise again. So in doing, you know, in doing the budget for this year, we've managed to pretty much balance it despite that massive loss by cutting things, and that was a horrible process, and I don't like the idea of cutting anything. I mean, obviously the cat bus was one of the obvious you know, high profile
victims.
The
Red Cat, wasn't it?
The Red Cat will be cancelled for up to 12 months entirely, and the Blue Cat has been halved. So essentially the Blue Cat was running with two buses so that it was every 10 minutes. It will now be running with one bus, so it's every 20 minutes. And the Red Bus won't happen at all because it's not as well used. But I guess also a lot of other things that, like, even I didn't really know that had happened until after it had happened, but we cancelled our tree planting for this year, and we're talking about not doing it in the next financial year as well. So, you know, that's 2 years where we don't contribute towards increasing our tree canopy, and given how much time it takes, and the green plan was one of the things that I had been able to achieve on council, and now that green plan is going to be stalled. So it's going to be a bit of a sad, challenging time while we, you know, recoup those kind of losses and rebalance the finances and so on associated with the losses. And I guess one of the questions that I've been asking myself, we've been having discussions on council, and I'm really curious to kind of hear what the community thinks of, is, of course, you know, we've always worked to the idea that a deficit is not a good thing. We try to balance the budget every year, and we don't want to operate beyond our means. But at the same time, maybe if we all acknowledge that these couple of years are really unusual and that every government is actually operating at a massive deficit, you know, maybe it's better to make sure that we still provide the services that people need and enjoy and want to have, knowing that we're going to have to take a little bit of time to pay it back. I mean, that's a reality we haven't faced yet, but it might be if our revenue doesn't increase again. And I guess that leads me to, you know, the role that the community plays, and the fact that, you know, what we need to do is, even though times are a bit tough for everyone and we've all taken various kind of financial hits, it's about supporting local businesses and getting out and about and staying connected to your community as well, and giving each other a bit of a break, knowing that
there are community groups planting trees. There are people that are keen to support their local businesses, and
yes.
I'm sure with the movies opening again soon, they'll be desperate to get back. And so, look, it's going to be a very interesting period.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I mean, at the same time, I guess the green in me also just sort of goes, maybe also this is a really worthwhile reset on our culture and habits and so on, where we were, as a society, we were quite used to having every need and will desire, you know, every...
Yes.
desire met pretty, you know, instantaneously, and had a tendency to kind of consume as much as we wanted without consideration of the implications of that. And maybe if we kind of rethink and rescale our choices in that way, yes. That might be a good thing that comes out of it too.
Now, finally, I get the strong impression that our mayor is going to finish up in the state parliament in the upper house, sort of about this time or a bit earlier next year. That'll be a change for the Fremantle community and council, will it not?
It will. I know, it will. I mean, it's a sad loss for Frio in some ways, in the sense that I think Brad has been a really good mayor. But I think it's also understandable that he feels the need to find new challenges. And I think he will play a really important and good role if he's in the state parliament too.
Yes. And that means there'll be a new mayor. And I suppose in that sense, the council will not be reinvigorated necessarily, but it'll be a different dynamic. It'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I do kind of watch with bated breath. You know, each time we have an election and there's a few people who kind of come and go and so on, the culture kind of adapts and shifts and so on, and it'll do that quite significantly next year, I think.
Local government democracy.
Yeah.
Well, Rachel, thank you very much for talking to Fremantle Shipping News today. It's been really lovely, and good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you. And thank you for all you do with the shipping news. It's wonderful to have a local media outlet like that.
Thanks very much. See you.